So let's begin this halachic overview with the first thing which will be upon us, which is, please God, the Shabbos, which is Parshas Zachor. So of course the basis of Parshas Zachor is which is what we'll be reading in Shul on Shabbos. In the Maftir are the Psukim in Dvarim, Parshas Ki Tetzé, in Dvarim Parakaf Hei, Zachor Es Asher Asalcha Amalek. So we're told in unambiguous terms by the Torah that we are supposed to remember what Amalek did to us. The question is whether that's merely a description, or even if it's a prescription, does that necessarily mean that it is a mitzvah? So this is itself a big discussion, but most Rishonim assume that in fact this pasuk is the basis of a mitzvah asay d'oraisa. So we are dealing with, according to most poskim, a mitzvah d'oraisa. You guys have to come to the table. You cannot sit back there. I will not give the shiur if you're sitting back there. That's like a whole, like, I don't mean you have to sit in the front row. That's a different point, but you have to be part of the shiur. No, but I'm not saying you have to sit in the front, but that's like not part of the shiur. That's like over there somewhere. Anyway, okay. So, Zachor is Sher Asolacha Amalek, according to the basis of a Mitzvah Aseh D'Oraisa. However, pretty much everything after that is completely unclear and left unambiguous. Right? So from the Pasuk, what don't we know? Right? Let's say there's a mitzvah, let's grant that. But what don't we know? Like every pertinent fact such as? How do you fulfill that? Right? What are options that you could imagine for that? All right, so that's something that you, first of all, that's how often, but we also don't know that either. So how often do you have to remember this? Right? So if I were to tell you, remember your husband who loves you, so how often are you supposed to remember that? Once a year? Well, no, he never remembers once a year, but how often do you remember this, right? So that's not clear from the pasuk. How you do it, right? What are the options for how you do it? How do you remember anything? Well, first of all, it could be purely mental. Does it have to be verbal? Does it have to be articulated? It can be articulated. Do I have to read psukim? If I read psukim, can it be from a chumash? Does it have to be from a Torah? Who said I have to read any psukim? Who is obligated in this mitzvah? Why are we obligated in the mitzvah? I think that pretty much covers all the things we have no idea about, despite the fact that the pasuk seems to be the basis of a mitzvah. So let's try to go through some of those, and then eventually we'll make our way to Purim itself. So first of all, how often are we supposed to remember this? So you have, amazingly, a range of pasuk are mentioned by the various Rishonim and Mefarshim. So the Sefer HaChinuch already in Mitzvah, Tav Reish Gimel, there at the end of the Torah in the Sefer Dvarim, he's one of the earliest ones to point out that there's no indication at all from the Torah how often we're supposed to fulfill this mitzvah. And he has a very kind of awkward formulation. He suggests, well, maybe it's every year or two or three. It's not clear at all. In fact, one of the commentary on the Sefer HaChinuch, the Minchas HaChinuch, he suggests that perhaps because it was such a kind of almost a clumsy formulation, that maybe the Sefer HaChinuch is referring to the fact that this is something that you can fulfill once in your lifetime. That would be one extreme position. Just from at some point in your life, you should acknowledge, you should remember what Amalek did to us. That's on the one extreme. On the other extreme, we have some achronim, the Shlach HaKadosh. There's also a sefer that counted the mitzvos called the Sefer HaCharedim. That's not a political sefer. It was written before that was a political term. This is, I think, if I'm not mistaken, a younger contemporary of Yosef Karo from Tzfat wrote the Sefer called the Sefer HaCharedim. And they both suggest, the Shlach and the Sefer HaCharedim, that actually perhaps there's a mitzvah every single day. It's one of those mitzvos tamidios. So you have on the one extreme, once in your life, two, every single day. Of course, our general assumption, at least the way we are kind of commonly used to fulfilling this mitzvah, is something in between. And that you find in a number of the Rishonim, the Rosh, the Smak, others suggest that this actually has to be done once a year. Now, where would that come from? Where do you get that from? So again, extremes are extreme, but at least they're always clarifying. So I think we could all make a plausible argument for either of the two extremes. Remember it means to acknowledge it once. Maybe it means to remember it all the time. I could theoretically hear either of those. Where does once a year come from? So a lot of the poskim point out that we have this concept in the Gemara and in other areas of halacha that as much as we all have different memories, and some of us have better memories than others, but from a halacha perspective, you know, we're always trying to quantify and objectify things. So the Gemara generally assumes that the shiur shikacha, the amount of time that something will be forgotten, is a year. That's where the issue of avelus comes in. That's why, for example, even though people have different minhagim lo aleinu when they put up a headstone, a matseva, but as far as I know, there's no minhag to go longer than a year. And the reason for that is because the assumption is that that's the zman, the time that people would forget something. So the Rishonim kind of imply, and those in this position explain that that's basically the idea, that zochor is supposed to be a constant remembering. We don't have to have it in the front of the brain every day, like those poskim say, but at least if we remind ourselves once a year, then it kind of lingers in our brain until the next year when we have to remind ourselves. Now, if the idea is that the 12 months, that a year is the shiur shikacha, so what question might that raise, particularly this year? Right. This Shabbos is actually 13 months since the last time we read Parsha Zachor. And in fact, there were those who had a discussion. Maybe in a leap year, you'll have to read Zachor in Adar Aleph and Adar Bet. So that's clearly not our practice. Why not? So this is kind of interesting. I think it's the Chasam Sofer who made the suggestion that when we say that a year is like kind of the sheer shikacha, it wasn't some kind of, you know, neuroscience insight that Chazal had about memory. Not at all. But rather, it meant that there was a cycle of life. And just like there's a cycle of life, there's the rhythm of a year. And in our memories, we kind of associate things with the calendar year. So if this year, the calendar year, is 13 months, but we remember last Pesach, remember last Purim we did Suda with them, or remember those kind of things. So the fact that this is the 13 months and not 12, but doesn't really change the fundamental bit in terms of the rhythm of our life, the calendar year is the memory block for people to have. So that's more or less where the practice comes that we're most familiar with of the Parsha Zachor once a year. Now there are people who try in the back of the Siddur on Shacharis to say the Pasuk, at least, you know, to remember it every day. That's a nice Hidur, but that's still not obligatory. We assume that the obligation can be met once a year. Okay, so that was the first question we had, which is the Pasuk doesn't tell us how often, but about how to do it. So the Gemara itself in Masechta Megillah points out that there's two halves of the Pasuk. I mentioned the Zachor, but there's also the Al Tishkach. Right? The Pasuk actually says, remember, and don't forget. So the Gemara actually says that Al Tishkach is something that's purely intellectual, that's something in the mind, but Zachor has to be Bepeh. It's not enough just to think about what Amalek did. It actually has to be articulated. So that part we have already from the Gemara. Now, do everyone have to say it? So the poskim say, no, it doesn't mean that everyone has to say it. No more than everyone has to read the Megillah, and everyone has to make Kiddush, and everyone has to make the bracha on the Hanukkah candles, or etc. Right? We have an idea of Shomea Ka'ona, that if you're listening to someone else, say the bracha or read the psukim, that can be as if you said it. So either you have to say it yourself, or you have to have been listening to someone who did it. Okay, but say what? Right? Nowhere yet have we seen any basis for the fact that somehow this needs to be done from a Sefer Torah. Yet not at all explicit in the Pesukim, clearly, but not even explicit in the Gemara. So to make a long story short, so this is an overview here, it ends up being implied by a discussion in the Gemara, but since it's only implied, there seems to be, interestingly enough, a machlokes. If you look at the Rambam and the Sefer Achinuch, for example, they never mention anywhere in their discussion of Parsha Zachor a Parsha, meaning the Torah. It's not Parsha Zachor, it's Mitzvah Zachor. So you could read it out of a Chumash, but you don't have to, at least it seems by omission, unnecessary for a Torah. However, other Rishonim, particularly Tosfos there in the Gemara, assume, again, the details are for now, they're interesting, but not our agenda today, but basically they understand there's a connection between this Mitzvah and the Megillah. So just like the Megillah has a text and a cloth, you know, a religious or a halachic, a mitzvah text, not just a printed book, but a real cloth. So too, they suggest that the mitzvah zachar has to be from a cloth as well. So that obviously, the overall minhag is to try to be machmir, for the position of Tosfos. That's why in every community that we've all been part of, that's where the minhag evolved of an actual Shabbos Zachor and a Parsha Zachor. Now, just because we're reading it from a Torah does not necessarily mean that you need a minyan. And that's, of course, something that becomes very relevant when you have the whole issue of second readings and women's readings, etc. So do you need a minyan or not? So the Rosh, in his commentary to Masechta Brachos, he actually assumes that you need not only a Sefer Torah, but like Kriyas HaTorah that we do on Shabbos or on a Monday, Thursday, or Rosh Chodesh, or Yom Tov, that you actually need a minyan. He actually suggests that this is the only example, and you probably have heard this probably announced by rabbis and shuls, if you're there for that announcement, if not at this stage of your life, then at earlier stages of your life, that this, and it's based on the Rosh, this, according to the Rosh, is the only example of a Kriyas HaTorah, which is Midoraisa, throughout the year. The whole institution of our weekly Torah reading is only Midorabanan, but he suggests, like, it's kind of paradoxical that the Maftir should be more important than the laning, but he suggests that it's not the laning per se, it's that through this we're filling the mitzvah of Parsha of Zechira Samalai. I keep on saying Parsha Zachor, which is a little bit of a misnomer, but according to the Rosh, it is Parsha Zachor. You have to fulfill this mitzvah, it's a Daraisa mitzvah, you have to do it through particular words, and it has to be with a full Kriyas HaTorah from the Torah itself. In fact, because of this, there were poskim who followed this position, who suggested, let's say you only have an opportunity to go to a shul if you're living in some woebegotten place, and you can either go on the Shabbos before to hear Parshas Zachor, or on Purim to hear the Megillah. I think, you know, viscerally, almost instinctively, most of us would assume, of course, you have to go hear the Megillah. But in fact, our poskim would say, Beis Narshan, on the contrary, the Megillah is very important, but it's a super derabanan because it's written in Tanakh. Megillah Esther is in Tanakh, so there's a term we use in halacha called divrei Kabbalah. That has nothing to do with Madonna. Divrei Kabbalah has nothing to do with Kabbalah in quotes. Divrei Kabbalah is a halachic term when you have something that's rabbinic. It's not midaraisa, but it's in Tanakh. It's a little bit of a super derabanan. So in the Megillah, reading Megillah Esther is what's called midivrei Kabbalah. It's important. But if you hold that Parsha Zachor is Doraisa, and you had a choice, so then you'd actually have to pick that. Others suggest there's a sefer called the Trumas Hadeshen. The Trumas Hadeshen was somebody named Isserlein. He lived in Germany, and he was kind of at the end of the period of the Rishonim. He wrote a book of Reshuvos, but he's particularly ingenious and famous for the fact that he never got stumped by any question in his Tshuva Sefer, for the simple reason that he wrote the questions. You can ace the test when you write the questions. So, in other words, it was a rhetorical device. Instead of just writing a sefer with essays, he thought it'd be more interesting to do a Q&A. So he presents the questions, and then he gives the answer. So the Trumas Hadeshen implies, and others suggested too, that it may not necessarily be the case that one needs a minyan. It may not be the same, again, paradoxical if you hold it's daraisa, but it may not be it might not be absolutely necessary to have a minyan. And this itself is a good segue for us to get to the bottom line for the people at this table. So with everything else that we've discussed, although clearly now we're getting something that's a little bit relevant, but who is obligated in this mitzvah? Ideally, we're doing it verbally, out of a text, out of a Torah text, ideally with a minyan, but maybe we could get away with it without a minyan. But who has to do this? So again, the men, let's assume that that's a given, that they're obligated, but it's not clear whether women should be obligated or not. And again, not only does the Torah not tell us anything, the Gemara tells us nothing either. So the first, one of the earliest to even address this is the Sefer HaChinuch. The Sefer HaChinuch, when he quotes the mitzvah, specifically tells us that men are obligated in the mitzvah and not women. Women are exempt. Why? So he says something very interesting. He says, why do we have this mitzvah to begin with? Why do we have to remember that? A long time ago. What about, and on the other hand, a lot of bad things have happened to the Jews. Right? There's no mitzvah to remember every bad thing that happened. Why is there a mitzvah of Zechiras Amalek? What do you think?
Because they were the first that...
They're after the Egyptians.
Right, but after it was already after, you know, Matan Torah and all the
miracles
of
the... It's a good point. If I ask the question the way I did, I'm not being fair, because I think you're all going to try to think of something philosophical or historical. Yeah.
People give that answer.
No, I'm not saying that that's not unique about Amalek. I'm saying that's why it's not fair. The Sefer HaChinuch is not thinking those terms. Halachically, why should there be an obligation? Let's leave out anything historical or philosophical. What other mitzvah is related or might be related to Zechira Samalek? There's another mitzvah in the 613. Mechia Samalek. So, are those mitzvahs related or not? They don't have to be, but the Sefer HaChinuch assumes that they are. There's the hop of the skip, and then that leads to the jump. So it says, he makes an assumption. There's no firm basis for this assumption, but he assumes that the whole purpose of remembering is so that you'll fight, right? If you know, a nation that forgets its history, so what's going to motivate them to risk their lives and to fight for anything if they don't remember where it came from? So he says that's number one. Number two, he assumes, we did the hop, now we get to the skip. What's the skip? He assumes that women are exempt from the mitzvah of Mechias Amalek. It's war, women don't go to war. That's number two. And therefore, that leads to his hop, skip, and a jump. The whole purpose of the mitzvah of remembering is to fight, and women are exempt from the fighting. So he suggests, therefore, women are exempt from the mitzvah of remembering. Now, this is accepted by some poskim, but many, many question one or both of his assumptions, right? He made two assumptions, the hop and the skip. The first is that this is connected to the war. Who said? Maybe there's the war, and maybe there's the remembering. And it's true that maybe if I was a general, or for that matter, the Kohen Mashuach Melchama or something, and I was going to get the troops riled up, I might remind them of what Amalek did to us. But that works in one direction. It does not mean, in the other direction, that there's no value to remembering, even if you're not the one going to war. So who said there's a connection? But number two, some poskim point out, who said that women are exempt of Mechias Amalek? Mechias Amalek is presumably what type of war?
Mechamet
Mitzvah. We know we have different categories. Simply, generally, the easiest way to say it is that there's two categories, Mechamet Mitzvah, Mechamet Rishus. And you would think, and this has firm basis, that a classic example of a Mechamet Mitzvah is Mechias Amalek. There is a mitzvah to go to war, to destroy Amalek. And there's a very well-known Mishnah, famous Gemara, that says when you have a Mechamet Mitzvah, who's obligated? Everybody's obligated. And the Gemara Chazal give a very famous and vivid formulation to describe that. Afilu, right? Even the Chosen and Kala, the Gemara says, have to go out. Kala Mechupasa, have to go fight in a Mechamet Mitzvah. So, either one or both of these assumptions that the Sefer HaChinuch makes are very, very debatable. Nevertheless, there were poskim who still felt that women are exempt. After all, and Rav Avadji Yosef mentioned this in one of his tshuvas, what exactly does that mean that women are obligated in the Mechamet Mitzvah? Does that mean that we have a purely, completely co-ed army and that women have to be trained in the same combat roles as men? So that's what it sounds like. At least many poskim say, no, that's not what it meant. What it means is, kind of like, I mean, I'm sure there's many other examples, including in Israeli history, but I just remember as a kid in American history, you would see the pictures of these things, the very active roles that women played on the home front during World War II, right? Whether it was helping behind the lines as nurses or other support staff, or for that matter, back in Ohio or Tennessee, in the factory doing the bullets or whatever, but that they should be part of the war effort, that they have to contribute. That Radvaz, other poskim say that's what it means, but that they're actually going to fight, no, that's not necessarily what it means. So some suggest all sorts of ways of defending this, but there is this position out there. It's important to realize that feel that women are completely exempt. On the other extreme, there was a great Gadol, German Gadol, named Rav Nosson Adler. Rav Nosson Adler is most well known, if he's known, is that he was the Chassam Sofer's Rebbe. Chassam Sofer and others quote him, but Chassam Sofer quoted him a lot, so even if you haven't heard of him, If he was Chassam Sofer's Rebbe, that tells us enough we need to know about who he was. And many poskim quote him that he felt that women are absolutely obligated. And probably because he rejected the whole equation to war. Who said one has to do with the other? You don't have to figure out how women are involved in war. Who said that there is that connected? Other poskim suggest that women are obligated for the same reason we're going to get to shortly when it comes to the mitzvahs of Purim, because of Avhein. The women were just as vulnerable to Amalek as anybody else. So if we have a miracle, so we're thanking Hashem, so we should remember that. Women should remember that as well. There is a middle position, which a number of poskim actually advocated, including Rav Moshe Feinstein, and maybe, I think others for sure, but certainly Rav Moshe Feinstein I know felt this way, which is that he said that women are obligated in the mitzvah, but not in the part that requires a Sefer Torah. Sure, Moshe felt that a woman should take out a chumash and read these psukim from Parshas Kisetze. You should verbalize it, and if you don't want to do it, you could have a group of women together, and one could say it for the others. But women should do them, fulfill the mitzvah. But doesn't who said they don't necessarily have to fulfill it through the medium of a Kriyas HaTorah? When all is said and done, none of this seems to matter because women want to fulfill this mitzvah. And that is the basis in, you know, many, many communities for the various second readings and third readings and late morning readings and afternoon readings of Parsha Zachor. Somebody who I work with in Yeshiva, who's very close with Rav Asher Weiss, told me that Rav Asher Weiss feels very strongly that women really are not obligated to hear Parsha Zachor from the Torah. But he already said after years of trying, he said, I threw up my hands. It's Exerish en atzibur yochel lamod bo. That's a plan. Usually that's a rabbinic phrase when the chachamim have a takana, which is very hard and demanding that people can't do. Here it's the opposite. The rabbis keep on saying to the women that maybe you're putter, and the women keep on coming to shul and asking for extra readings. And therefore, that's why in many, many communities that is the minhag. I assume it will be in Ganela, but we're not ready to make any decisions on that yet. That's not the purpose of today's shiur. I only say that because, in all seriousness, there is a discussion, about bringing a Sefer Torah out for a separate reading, which is outside of the Mizgeret of a minyan, of Darusha Magdusha. If you have a minyan of men who haven't heard it yet, then that would be by far the best solution. But without a minyan, in many, many shuls, including the shul I was once rabbi of in Baltimore, there was a second reading after davening, and women who couldn't be at the first minyan came. It's very, very common, but you should know that this is the background. It's not obvious that that's necessary. And even certainly if you're in a community or in your personal situation, you can't get the shul, not for the first or the second reading, so that you shouldn't feel so bad. First of all, you might really be exempt, and even if you're a chayiv, there's other ways to do it. You should read the psukim from the chumash. Okay? Any questions on that, or are we ready to get to the holiday of Purim itself? Yes.
Can you be Yotzei through
Parsha Kitinze,
like when you heard it?
Yes. Thank you very much for bringing that up. So that's another thing which rabbis hopefully are on the ball to remind people of, which is not Bashalach, which is just the story of what happened, but you don't have the word Zachor there, but the Parsha of Zachor in Kiseitze, yes, so in the summer, or the fall, or whatever that is, that you get to Kiseitze, in many shuls they will actually announce, if you didn't have a chance to hear Parsha Zachor, have in mind to be Yotzei the mitzvah now. Okay, there's many more things to discuss about Zachor, if you recall from year to year, Zecher versus Zecher, or all those kind of things, but we'll leave some of those details and we'll move on. So actually, we're actually not ready 100% for Purim yet. The next thing on the calendar as we move closer to the holiday is Tainis Esther, the fast day. So where does all that come from? So usually, other than Yom Kippur, all of our rabbinic fasts are mentioned in the famous Pasuk in the Navi Zechariah in Parakhes, which discusses the four fasts. The problem is on our calendar we have five fasts. And what's the odd woman out? Tainis Esther. In other words, there are four fasts mentioned by the Navi that we have throughout the year. Shavasar Batamuz, Tisha B'Av, Tzom Gedalia, and Asar B'Teves. But we don't have Tainis Esther. It does not appear anywhere in the Tanakh as an obligatory fast. So you'll say, well, isn't it in Megillas Esther? You tell me. What is the purpose? What are we commemorating in Tainis Esther? This is not clear at all, because there's no psukim that specifically say there's an obligatory fast to commemorate X. So if you think it, one possibility is, I think, more obvious. What's the first thing that comes to mind as the basis of Tainis Esther? I'll give you a hint. Tainis Esther. Esther's fasting. right? So she fasted. That was connected to the Yeshua. Amazing, right? What's the problem with that? It was on Nisan. In fact, the Gemara says it was Leil HaSeder was the first night. In fact, originally, this is just as an aside, but it's an amazing line in the Gemara, and the Medrash quotes this, Chazal say, that originally when Esther asked to fast, the response was, how could you do that? You're going to be Mevatel the Pesach Seder. But Esther had the wisdom, and she stared down the Sanhedrin, and she said, if we are not Mevatel this Seder, there will be no more Sedarim. And Chazal accepted her insight and her wisdom. So that was in Nisan. So if we were going to fast to commemorate her fast, we're like a month late. So what's the alternative? The alternative is less obvious. Anyone have any ideas? Anyone remember? Maybe you've learned it in the past. What would be the, if that's not the paradigm, then what is? So the poskim suggests something which is even less obvious than that, which is that we know that at the end of the Megillah, the Jews go to war against their enemies. There's no mention in the Megillah at that point in the story. That's like the exciting part, the end. There's no mention there about a fast. But the poskim suggests, Koros, that historically, the Jews always used to fast. I'm talking about like biblically. I don't mean like modern history. I mean biblical history. In Tanakh, they used to fast before going to war. So some poskim suggest that min hastam, it must have been, that they fasted before those wars in the time of Mordechai and Esther. Now, the weakness in that is that it's made up out of whole cloth. There's no makor anywhere for that. Not in the Tanakh, not in the Medrash. The upside is, at least calendarically, then it works out. So if you look at Mishneh Berurah, these are both quoted as possibilities. No one really knows for sure. So we don't have it in the Pasuk in the Navi Zechariah. No one really knows for sure why we're fasting to begin with. And when you add 1 and 1 plus 2, what you get is, by far and away, the most lenient fast on the Jewish calendar. The reason that there are so many kulas when it comes to Zionist Esther is because of this. It has very, very modest beginnings and origins. We're really not sure where it comes from or why. As a result, if you look in Shulchan Aruch, the Shulchan Aruch basically says it's not exactly a chova. Of course, anyone who is otherwise healthy and can fast should do it, and to not fast is like Poreitz Geder. You know, you're not allowed to just ignore what the rest of the Jewish people are doing, but it's really not an obligatory fast on the level of even the other rabbinic fasts. And that's why the Shulchan Aruch, for example, says even if a person is just in pain, they can break their fast. You know, as we know, whether it's in fasting or, let's say, Hilchos Shabbat, we have different categories of chole. God forbid there's a chole, sheyesh bo sakana, someone whose life is even possibly misafek at risk. And then you have the much more common category of a chole, someone who's really sick, but it's not like their life is in danger. So that second category, if it's a shivasar batamas or asar batavis, so you're allowed to break your fast. But if you just have a little bit of a headache, you should try to, you know, soldier on. Says the Shulchan Aruch, when it comes to Tainus Esther, even if you have something which is not so common, it's funny that this is the example that is given, but even if you have an eye ache. Yeah, I guess you could, right. Maybe, yeah, you know, it's a very good point, actually. I never thought of that, because I have suffered.
It's
in my younger years, I suffered a lot, actually, from migraines, and it was always over, you know, right there. Right there. So maybe that's the phrase where Chazal got that from. I'm not sure. It's a very good suggestion, actually.
Very relevant.
Yes. So, first of all, yes, so anybody, male or female, if you have really any real discomfort which is clearly attributable to fasting, or at least could be reversed by not fasting, very, very lenient. As I say, the bar is pretty low to break your fast. Beyond that, the Mishneh Berurah and others discuss, what about someone who's pregnant or nursing? So there are poskim who suggest automatically don't even start if you're pregnant or you're nursing. You don't even have to fast. Don't even try. Other poskim say, no, pregnant, they should try. But like anybody, you get the first, you know, first bit of discomfort, which you say maybe is going to be a guarantee. Okay, so maybe according to those poskim, fast till 10 in the morning or whatever, and or 11, whatever it is. That's two opinions quoted in the Mishneh Berurah. My impression is that the common minhag is like the more lenient view. I think in general, again, I can't speak for common poskim in Ramat Beit Shemesh. I haven't done a survey locally, but in my broader experience, I think that the minhag is to be makil. That first of all, as you know, this is not our topic, but in many communities, women are very lenient on many fast days. I'm not a fan of that. sorry. But you want equality, I'll give you equality. Equality of fasting. But in all seriousness, but I think that if someone who is pregnant or nursing generally could be mekel, you could even go more lenient than that if you want. There is an opinion of the Maharsham. The Maharsham is the namesake and the grandfather of the Maggid of Yerushalayim, Shalom Shwadron, the famous Maggid. So his grandfather and namesake, the Maharsham, he had a famous shita, which there are poskim who will use even nowadays, who felt that once a person is pregnant, you have 24 months. Whether you're currently pregnant, actively nursing, it's a 24-month period, which is why you have certainly women in many certain cases who could go 20 years without fasting other than on Yom Kippur, because they're never more than 20 months, 24 months away from... Maybe.
I was talking
about
when I was pregnant.
Yeah,
really?
So...
24 months from the Leda or from being pregnant?
I think after you gave birth. I think after, yes, you have a long time. Yeah, you have like a lot of time. Anyway, that's obviously, I would say case by case, community by community, rabbi by rabbi kind of case. But again, certainly if a person is pregnant or nursing, I would if you're in a community in which there's a very easily defined, you know, clearly defined minhag that pregnant women do fast, then I think you should. But I don't know yet of such a community. And as far as I'm familiar with, it's very common that uptime sester people are lenient. Any questions on that? Okay, good. So let's get to the holiday of Purim. Let's get to some good, happy halacha. So we have four mitzvos on Purim, and we'll discuss all of them, please God. So the first one, of course, is Megillah reading. So the Gemara tells us, and the Shulchan Aruch paskens this way, I've already alluded to this, that men and women are obligated in the mitzvah of Mikra Megillah. Is that a surprise? Well, it depends. If you think of it experientially, it's not a surprise, you get your whole life. But if you think of it conceptually, it is somewhat of a surprise. Why do I say that? Because it would seem, at first glance, that Mikra Megillah should be an obvious candidate for being exemption based on Mitzvah Aseh Shahasman Grama. That's not just at first glance, that's actually at second glance too. It is a Mitzvah Shahasman Grama. So how come I just said that the Gemara says that women are obligated? Because Mitzvah Shahasman Grama is not an ironclad rule. There are exceptions to the rule. And one of the most famous categories of exceptions is the rule of Afhein Hayub Osahaneis. So what exactly does that mean? Is actually a machlokes. There's one opinion in the Rishonim, which I say makes more sense literally, which is that women were also beneficiaries of the miracle. So whether it's on Pesach, or on Chanukah, or on Purim, in all of those cases, the women were potentially victims as much as the men, and in some cases, unfortunately, more vulnerable than the men, and therefore they benefited from the miracle. I think that's the easiest way to understand the words. But it's just interesting. I don't know if there's any actual practical difference, but there is an opinion in the Rishonim that says no, not that they were also beneficiaries of the Nais, but in all three of those examples, the women were catalysts of the miracle. So obviously, the best example of those three is actually Purim's story with Esther. But be that as it may, whichever the explanation is, the Gemara is clear in the Shulchan Aruch Paskins that women are obligated to hear the Megillah, and as we all know, although this is a sugi in its own right, but we read the Megillah twice. We read the Megillah at night and during the day. That is itself an interesting topic. I don't know if you ever wondered, why do we do that? We don't shake the lulav at night and in the morning, or do it until... So why do we do that is not tonight's topic, but that's it's interesting. But if that's the obligation for men, so that is apparently also the obligation for women. Now, even though we say that both men and women are obligated, does that mean that they are equally obligated? Now, you'll say, well, what's the difference? Is that just semantics? It's not semantics at all. If men and women were equally obligated, what would be possible? Women could read the Megillah for men. And that is a possibility that is discussed in the Rishonim. Many, many, many Rishonim paskin that is in fact possible. In Shulchan Aruch, we're against it. But that's based on the Shulchan Aruch being machmir for a minority view. that says that there's a, even though both men and women are obligated, but they're not necessarily identically obligated. And there's huge literature to try to understand this minority view in different. It's not at all simple. Not at all simple. If I'm not mistaken, I think a few years ago in my Shabbos year for the men, I think I gave a whole discussion on this once, if I remember correctly. But let's say simply, the most common notion, I think, is that perhaps a women's obligation is just to lishmoa, to hear the Megillah, whereas men's obligation might be defined as both lishmoa but also mikra Megillah. But that's not obvious, or necessarily true, but that's at least a possibility. Be that as it may, it is a pre-modern, pre-controversial times, when it was just a halachic, not a political or hashkafic issue, this was a real discussion in post-gim, but the conclusion is that women should not read for men. I'm sorry. But women should not read for... Yes, we're going to get to that in a second. So I started off with the most extreme case. So women should not read. That is pretty clear in the Shulchan Aruch. What about a woman reading for herself or for other women? So this is also a discussion. And here it seems pretty clear on the page of the Shulchan Aruch that Mikra Din, that would be absolutely permissible. 100% permissible. And this is why, again, without meaning to digress at all, but this is why, as you, some of you may be familiar with, even in circles where, let's say, women laning is condemned and not allowed, you do have some pretty major poskim who, at least for seminaries or in other more limited contexts, have allowed women's Megillah reading, where women read for other women. So again, without getting into the political or hashkafic or other issues, from a strictly Hilchos Purim, Hilchos Megillah perspective, that is a very, very well-grounded and justifiable position. Just open up the Shulchan Aruch, and you'll see that it is allowed. So why might there be a problem with that? Again, without getting into any other extra halachic issues. So there is an opinion that is quoted by the Magen Avram, which is quoted by the Mishnah Berurah, so it's certainly important to be cognizant of, that suggests that even if there may be a real firm ground, in a very strict sense, nevertheless, the Magen Avram, quoted by the Mishnah Berurah, still says it's not preferable. Why he says that, again, that would take us the rest of the shir. I don't want to go too much down the rabbit hole. But just so you should know, it is discussed, and if you go beyond the page of the Shulchan Aruch, you go to the bottom, and you go to the 20th century, and you see the Mishnah Berurah, and he's quoting from the Magen Avraham, who certainly lived before that. So there is a strong preference, at least once you get into those later poskim, for women not to do that. And for women to fulfill their mitzvah, it's assumed in this case by a more optimal way of hearing a man read the Megillah. But I do think, as far as I know, I don't know if anyone would disagree with this, if a woman was in a situation where that was not possible, I'm not now discussing whether l'chachila, a woman has an option to go to shul and hear the man read in shul, is it appropriate for her to choose to go to a woman's Megillah reading? We're not discussing that. But let's say she's in a situation where there is no man to read the Megillah, and she's capable. If she's not capable, then it's moot. But if you are capable, so then I think there's no question that a woman should do that. And if the only person who can read for you is another woman, there's no question that you should absolutely do that. And according to everyone, as far as I know, certainly by the time you get to Shulchan Aruch, you would absolutely be Yotze through that. But let's assume that that's not common in this community. No shortage of Megillah readings. But let's say there's a discussion which is relevant, probably many of you, where if you have younger children at home, so maybe you don't go to shul, your husband goes to the original minyan, and then there's we had the later Parsha Zachor, so there's also the later Megillah reading. So that is very, very common, very, very, very mikubal. There is some discussion about what bracha should be made. Again, alluding to what I said before, is it al-mikra Megillah, which is the standard bracha? Some poskim say that the nusach of the bracha should be changed if even the one reading, even if the Baal Kore, the male reading, has already fulfilled his mitzvah, so then maybe it should be a lishmoa or something like that. But I'll leave that to the Baal Kriya and the particular groups of people who get together for that. But that itself is a discussion on the pages of the Shulchan Aruch. One last point, again, if this just round out the circle, which is that at the end of Megillah reading in shul, how many of you are at an age or a stage of life where you can come to shul for the main Megillah reading? Who I know is one, two, three. Okay, so
I wouldn't
do it anyway. Too noisy. Okay, that can be not in Gani Elo shul. Okay.
I like the one of Junas because they're
Right, no groggers, no groggers.
No, in Marshall there is grogger, but whatever, the women do just like a second.
Not like the kids.
That's it.
Okay, fine. Anyway, so what you may recall, especially those of you who go to the shuls, is that after the Megillah reading, there's a whole other bracha, Haravas Rivenu. So that usually is not said without a minyan. So if you're at a woman's reading, you may, again, sometimes you don't notice the things you're omitting. But if you're looking in the Megillah and you see right there in the Megillah, Haravas Revenu, so in a woman's reading, you would not be saying that. Okay, any questions about Megillah before we get to the shorter topics? We have some shorter issues still to go, which are the other mitzvahs of the day. Any questions on Megillah reading?
Is the trap edemakev, like...
No. The pronunciation of the words is...
Right.
Right, but the pronunciation is
loud. Yeah.
Yes, I mean, it doesn't have to be loud, but just like that, I mean, it should be audible. Okay? Yes, please.
Yeah, just about the need to listen to every single word. I know you typically speak in houses. There's always someone coughing, even if it's not conventionally.
Can I add something? Can I add something? Just from, this is not even a gender thing, because often it's the fathers who are worse than the moms. But it's often because there's a child who's making noise and the parents don't take them out.
Right.
That will not happen in our shul. Anyway.
In general,
but yes.
At what point do you actually have to worry?
So it's a real issue. So again, if you really are missing words, then it's a problem. That's why, again, it's very, recommended to be following along. Some have the Hidur following along from a kosher Megillah. But even if you're following along from a Chumash, the post can say if it's a word here and there, even if you just read it to yourself in the Chumash, it would be okay.
Like say it out loud?
Yes. Not read with your eyes, but yes, articulate it.
It's not like a suffix of one word that should make...
Again, if you didn't hear the one word and you didn't say it, then that it could be a real issue even for one word. But if you realize that there's someone that's distracting and you're quickly saying it quietly, again...
But then when you say it, they're probably...
Yes, it's a very difficult situation. Yes, it is a very difficult situation.
Say it when it's up to Haman.
Yes, it's frustrating. It is frustrating, yes. Yes. Yeah, you cannot read the Megillah out of order.
You have to read until you catch up to where they're...
Yes. If you don't take care of it in a split second, you won't be able to take care of it. That's reality. So you have to really concentrate and try to tune out the other distractions. And again, it is by far preferable, especially for those of us with young children, to split that time or get it, whatever it is, whether it's with a husband or a babysitter, so that you can go and be able to focus on that. If you're also worrying about your children and everyone else's children, I can tell you in advance, it's probably fafalin. It's not going to happen. And I say that whether you're a male or a female. It's just not going to happen. Okay, next, Mishloach Manos. So what is the mitzvah of Mishloach Manos? Again, it's in the Megillah. The Gemara quotes it. The Shacharach quotes it. We have a minimum of 2 gifts to another person on Purim Day. That's the easy definition of Mishloach Manos. 2 gifts to at least one person on Purim Day. Why? Why do we have to give Mishloach Manos? Again, not obvious at all in the Megillah, and not even obvious in the Gemara. Anyone have any ideas? That's who you give it to. That's not why you give. Why do you give? That might be, you might be onto something, but it's not explicit, right? So what do you think? Why do we have to give Mishloach Manos? There's a lot of smart women here.
The words Ishlarev to increase friendship.
Okay, so someone else quietly whispered that as well. I heard you. Very good. Yes, so one possibility, some very smart women, as well as our Shlomo Alkibitz, is that the purpose is to foster, both to reflect and to foster friendship. The Shlomo Alkibitz is most famous, who wrote what familiar tefillah that we all know and love? L'chadodi. Look in your Archival Siddur, it will tell you. Or Shlomo Alkibitz, who was a Kabbalist, also from Tzfat around the time of Rav Yosef Karo. You can see his grave when you go to the old cemetery in Tzfat. So he wrote the L'chadodi. He also, less famously, wrote a commentary on Megillas Esther called the Menos HaLevi. And there, he has a very beautiful insight. When Haman is convincing Achashverosh to give him permission to kill the Jews, he describes, who is this people? Yeshno, Am Echad, Mufuzar, and Mufurad Bein Ha'amim. So in the, the Pshat HaMikra, what's Haman saying, obviously? You can't trust them, you don't know where to find them, they're slippery, the classic anti-Semitic canard against the Jews. But the Menos HaLevi understands it more metaphorically and more spiritually. He says, in essence, what was Haman's accusation? Really what's going on is, what was the chait? Why are we so vulnerable, right? I don't believe Haman hated us any more than probably 1,000 other people, or maybe millions of other people throughout history. There are a lot of people who wish they could have killed us. But not that many people got as close. Not that many people got as close as Haman. So why did Haman almost pull it off? So says the Shlomo Algebetz, that's embedded, encoded by Esther and Mordechai Baruch HaKodesh into the words of Haman. Yeshno am echad mefuzara mefurad. They have no achdus. They're internally divided. It's not geographical. It's that on a spiritual, emotional level, they're all just divided people. And therefore, what was the tikkun? What did Esther require before she went to Achashverosh? Gather everyone together. The ikkur, he says, was not the fasting and the sackcloth. It was that everyone was ba'achdus when they davened and fasted with the sackcloth. And therefore, when it came time to memorialize the miracle and create a holiday, he says they have a mitzvah called Mishloach Manos, to both recall and to foster that same unity. Laharbos Ava Achba Bereus, in his words. That's one very strong possibility. Anyone think of another possible reason or rationale for Mishloach Manos? Excellent. So another possibility is the Suda, and this is a suggestion that is offered by the same, I mentioned the Sefer earlier, the Trumas Hadeshen. Again, he asked the question and he got it right because he wrote the question. So the Trumas Hadeshen asked himself the following question, which will sound surprising to you now because we live in a post-Shulchan Aruch world, but he lived slightly before the Shulchan Aruch, and he asked the following question: can you give clothing or bedding or linens and the like for Mishloach Manos? Or does it have to be food? And he reaches the conclusion that he thinks it must be food items. Again, the word manos is somewhat vague. Who said that means food? It means items. So he says it means food. How did he know that? So he suggests, because it goes to the rationale of the mitzvah. What's the rationale, his opinion? To make sure that people have enough for the su'uda. Maybe. So we'll get to that in a second. Excellent. But what's interesting is that what he's basically saying is that Mishloach Manos is really an adjunct of someone else. It's really not its own mitzvah as much as it's an adjunct of the mitzvah of Suras Purim. So you are very correct in thinking the wheels in our minds should start turning. You're one step ahead of us, which is what presumably with such different conceptions of the mitzvah, there presumably will be ramifications, nafkamina, to that question. So one is the one that I already telegraphed, which is, does it have to be food? So the Trumas Hadeshen says, you betcha. If it's for the Suda, it has to be food. So Shulchan Aruch passes this way. But you know who disagrees among others? Apparently, we have a tradition, even historically, that it's the Ramah, none other than the Ramah. And he suggests it doesn't necessarily have to be food. And as an alternative, he suggests, what about a Sefer? And the legend goes, the Ramah, the one we know from Halacha, he wrote a commentary on Megillas Esther called Mechir Yayin. Actually, Mosada Rav Kook redid it and published it very beautifully a few years ago. And the tradition is that the year he wrote it, he gave that as Mishloach Manos. Nice.
In fact, before he made
the Suda. I guess. Obviously he doesn't think that the mitzvah is to help with the Suda. So what must he think? Presumably, like Rosh Shlomo Alkovitz, he felt that it was based on Ava V'Achva. Now, I know lots of people, in all seriousness, who you'd make very happy, maybe even more happy than a few stale Hamantashen or whatever, is if you gave them a no sefer. That'd make them very happy. That would be a real bonding experience. So that's one possible nafkamina. Another one that's quoted by some of the poskim: let's say you knock on someone's door, you want to bring them a Mishloach Manos, and they say, come over a second, you see my kitchen table? No, I don't see it. You know why you don't see it? Because it's covered by mountains and mountains of food. And I got it organized. I got the chips there. I got the sodas there. The wine there. There's so much food. Do me a favor. Please give it to someone who needs. I don't need any more. My kids, their teeth. Oh, give up. You're mochel. Simply, you say, no, thank you. I really appreciate it. But thank you. Let's say, again, in classic halachic hypotheticals, let's say the person who knocked on your door, he only has to get to one person, and the one person was you. And now you say, no, thank you, I'm Michael. And they say, okay, I'm going home now. Did they fulfill their mitzvah or not? So this is discussed by the poskim, and some suggest that it goes back to the same question. If it's based on helping the su'uda, so some suggest that, practically speaking, you got to give them the food. You can't eat a thought. You know, it doesn't. Good intentions don't help for food. But if it's about showing the love, you did show love. These guys are they're buddies. You came over. I thanked you. I hugged. I had a l'chaim. Whatever. Maybe. I'm not saying it's definitive, but possibly. I'll give you one other one, which is very interesting, which is the Ksav Sofer. That's the son and successor of the Chasam Sofer. His son's name was Avram. So he says a following tshuva. Let's say you gave anonymously. Every year I get one of those, but I think they're usually by accident. You know, the card fell out, the card got forgotten to be put in. But let's say you get one, and you don't know who gave it to you. And let's say if we knew, through our crystal ball, that person who did give it to you only gave you. Were they Yotze or not? And I didn't turn it down. I took it, I enjoyed it, I ate it. So the Ksav, he thinks it would also be relevant. He says, if it was about helping the Suda, so you helped, and you helped anonymously. That's wonderful. But if it's about the Kesher, the interpersonal relationship, so we call that a stalker, not a that's, you know, there's no kindred spirit. On the contrary, they're going to be upset you never said thank you. You're going to be upset, how come they never gave me? It was anonymous, doesn't help at all if you're talking about fostering friendship. Now, how far do you take this about the Suda if we want to go in that direction is a good question. So, for example, I once heard from Rav Schechter that he thinks that you cannot give desserts, even though, of course, everyone gives dessert. And even though he then adds that, he says, my wife, she doesn't really listen to me because apparently Rav Schechter's wife is famous for making homemade, very ungepatscht chocolates that she gives out. But he and his shirim always thinks that you can't give desserts. You have to give, like, ikar suda stuff, like real, you know, wine, meat, things like that. So you could go that far. Other poskim discuss, what about if it's raw? Does it have to be edible in its current state? Or, you know, how far do you take this? And another possibility is the milchiks. But you are putting the cart before the horse, because we didn't yet decide, does the meal have to be fleishiks? Okay? So, no, conceptually, your mind, you were on the right track completely, that would present possibly be a nafkamina. But that's, again, there's more. I have a whole essay that I wrote and published once with like 15 nafkamina this question. So I just gave you like the three or four of them. But what are some of the other issues just to quickly mention about shalachmanos, and then we'll get to suda, then we'll just see if the suda has to be fleishiks. But we didn't get there yet, but you might have a nafkamina. We'll have to hold off on that. But one is very important, very practical nowadays, which is communal shalachmanos. Are you yotzei with communal shalachmanos or not? Right, you check off, you know, your 78 nearest friends from the shul, and they get this nice basket with a huge list. Let's say you only did that. You didn't do anything else. Are you? Maybe, maybe not. It depends. Is there enough in that communal shalachmanos so that every person gave the shtei manos? So I guess it really depends on how popular that person, the recipient, was. Mm-hmm. If there are 78 names on that list, it would have to be a really big shalachmanos trying to be yotzi anything with that. It's a very nice gesture. It's a good way for shuls or yeshivas to make money. But most poskim recommend that you should give at least one, quote-unquote, real shalachmanos, and not just rely on the common shalachmanos, because that can be very, very, very dicey. We're all familiar with the fact that you have to give at least two different types of food. That is important. That's discussed. Two different manos, two different types of food. Poskim even discuss, is dark meat and white meat the same? If you want to be really picky about it. But two different types of food.
Doesn't have to be two different brachas.
Oh, so we have this discussion in our house almost every year. And somebody, usually very learned in the house, says, and they have to be two separate brachas, right? To which someone else in the house, who also learned a little bit, always says, it's a total myth. I'm the one saying it's a total myth. It's totally, now how come all the other wise and learned people in my house and other people's houses think that? Because the kindergarten teachers teach kids this. I don't know who the first kindergarten teacher who made it up is, but it's absolutely not true. It's a total myth. If you want one proof, when the Rambam discusses shalachmanos, he gives the example of giving two pieces of meat. As far as I know, all meat is a shahakal. There's no such thing as different brachos. You can give a shahakal soda and a shahakal meat. You can give, but it has to be two different things. And you know, if you're really worried about giving white meat and dark meat, you'll ask me that shyly later. But two different types of food are sufficient for that. What about women? Are women obligated in Mishloach Matos? The answer is yes. Mishloach Matos passes, women are obligated. Also because of Afein Hayib Osa Hanes. There are some poskim, the Kitzur Shulchan Aruch says that women, even married women, should be makbit do themselves to give their own. But many other poskim, and I think the very, very prevalent minhag is for husbands and wives to give together. And again, assuming that you only would have a shaila if you only gave two things to one person. Assuming that you as a couple are giving lots of things to lots of people, even if it's not a theme, you can be yotze without a theme. Then I think you are saying, okay, that is the common, that is the... No. Okay, briefly, Matanos Levyonim. How much do you have to give for Matanos Levyonim? Again, two gifts, but here to two people, the Gemara says. So that's meaning one to one and one to one. So altogether, you gave two and two. We have the custom to give money. It's quoted by the Magen Avraham to give money, but it's not obvious that you had to give money. And if you didn't have money to give, but you had something else to give the poor person, Ikra, then I think you would be, you would say, how much do you have to give? So according to the Rishonim, minimal. I mean, I'm talking about agorot type value. Certainly a few shekel would be sufficient. But the poskim say, you know...
I heard once said that you have to give enough that the ani could buy a meal with it.
No. You need, let's focus on the right verb, you need to give incredibly minimal amount. However, there are poskim who suggest that nowadays you should give people enough that they can enjoy, you know, the holiday through it. But that is a hidur, that is not mikra hadin. Moreover, what you just mentioned as well, so the Rambam and others say, and this is important in all modern communities where people are going out of control on Mishloach Manos. So the Rambam says if you have a choice, and we all have to make choices because none of us have unlimited money, have a choice of all the mitzvahs of the day, the one you should give the most, spend the most on is Matanos Levyonim. The idea that people give, you know, 20 shekel or $20 even to the pushka and then spend hundreds of dollars on Mishloach Manos is completely backwards from a halachic and hashkafic perspective. It would be much, much better to give minimal Mishloach Manos and give all that money away to Matanos Levyonim. All of your friends who have at least as much money as you, are all Baruch Hashem doing fine, please God, more or less. So none of us are Avyonim, thank God. You know, giving each other, you know, more and more, you know, theme park, Mishloach Manos, while the Aniyim get, you know, 100 shekel or something. That's not, that really shouldn't be done. Okay, very quickly, the Sudas Purim. So Sudas Purim, again, an obligation to Yom Mishtev Simcha, a large meal, to celebrate on the Purim day. Very important, the Suda has to be on the day. Yeah, it cannot be too late, not can't be too early, it has to be on Purim day, but technically any time during the day, which comes up when Purim's on Friday, and sometimes people have breakfast sudos, or you have, in some cases, not in Eretz Yisrael, Baruch Hashem, Baruch Shezachinu, but in Chutz La'aretz, lots of men go to work, maybe some women even, but certainly men sometimes have to go to work on Purim. It's very, very sad. I know women who like men who had like a bagel at their office and counted that as the Purim Suda.
I worked 1 year.
It's very sad.
But it was only in the morning.
Right. Okay. Right. So it could happen. Thank God in Eretz Yisrael it's much, much less common. What about meat? So this is not obvious or clear, but the Aruch Chaim and others say it is proper to have a meat meal. How far do you take it? Interestingly, a number of the contemporary poskim suggested, even the Moshe Halberstam from Eid Haredes and others said, you know how important it is to have meat at the Suda? Even a woman who's going to the mikveh that night should have meat at the Suda. Even though we all know that the day you're going to the mikveh, you're not supposed to have meat or something stringy that could get caught in your teeth. But they suggest, despite that usual practice, but even if you have going to mikveh that night, you should have meat at the Suda. And then, of course, just be careful to make sure you don't have a problem when
so
you go to
the
mikveh.
Meat, like,
yes, yes. So what if you don't like meat? What if you don't like meat? What about chicken? So the poskim say it's really not considered basar. Halachically, basar does mean meat. But if a person really doesn't like meat, so then just like on a yontif where you're supposed to have meat, if you don't like it, you don't like it. Better to have chicken and enjoy it, or fish and enjoy it, than meat if you don't like it. But if you do like it, then you should definitely try to have it. There's a machlokas about bread. Does it have to be a hamotzi meal or not? The minhag is to do it, but it's not mikra din that it has to have hamotzi. Okay, any questions on this?
What if someone doesn't eat?
At all?
Or chicken or animal products?
Well, what do they eat? You mean like a vegetarian?
Vegetarian.
So then they should... So they have that's no different than their shayla on every Yom Tov and every Shabbos.
I guess
okay. The Purim Suda is the least of the I'm saying then they won't. I mean, then I'm not. You know, you
is
can't.
Their problem? That's basically.
If they really need it, when I say can't, I mean because they don't like it. Let alone if there's health issues. But if they right. then, no, we don't force anyone to eat. No, we don't. You know, for some. Okay, I'll just end. I think just very, if you don't mind, give me 2 more minutes with a beautiful thought. One of the things that we do not do on Purim is say Hallel. Why not? It seems pretty funny. Why shouldn't we say Hallel on Purim? So the Gemara already asked that question. The Gemara gave 3 answers. One answer, anyone know? Well, we don't say Hallel because it wasn't in Eretz Yisrael. Oh, Baruch Hashem, we're here. The one answer was the miracle didn't take place in Eretz Yisrael. Second answer. Excellent. Just the Hallel is to publicize and thank Hashem for a miracle, so the Megillah is a substitute for that. Anyone know the third one?
The Yeshua didn't come when something.
Close. You're close. Akate Avde Achashverosh Hanan. We all, you know, this, when the story ends, what happens? They're still in Golos. They're still the servants of Achashverosh. They're not under a genocidal decree, but that you can't compare to Pesach, as Mara says, you know, where we went completely free and, you know, Paro and his minions were killed and destroyed. Those are 3 answers given in the Gemara. But I saw it very briefly, and I was thinking about it this year. We've had such a hard year. Terrorism and just so many difficult things this year. So Rav Tzadok HaKohen of Lublin, the great Hasidic Rebbe, Rav Tzadok in one of his Svarim says, working off of that last idea, I guess, but really it's an original idea. He says, you see from the Gemara that there's 2 paradigms. There's the paradigm of Pesach and the paradigm of Purim. He says, we may not say Hallel, but despite all those 3 reasons, and Akate Avde Achashverosh, we're still servants, we do have a holiday. So what do you see from that? He says that there's 2 models of celebration, 2 models of redemption. He says Pesach is a holiday where we celebrate leaving the darkness. And Purim is a holiday where we celebrate learning how to survive in the darkness. Not every experience in life for our people or for us as individuals is a Pesach experience where we have this amazing thing and everything is better. Like when we're children, we think that life works that way. Most of life is Purim, not Pesach. And says Rav Tzadok, Purim is an incredibly important holiday, because that is the holiday that teaches us that there can be a Yeshua even betoch hachoshech. And we have to look to find those small things to be thankful to Hashem for. And that perhaps may not have a Hallel. It is different than a Pesach, but it is still worthy of celebration. And even if our hearts are a little bit heavy this year, as I think they should be, but they should also be celebratory, because we obviously all have so much to be thankful for. Okay, thank you very much for coming. I know it was-